Welcome back to Misunderstood. So this might be the part two to the part one, or it might be a completely different thing.
Yeah.
We're back where we wanted to further the conversation. We kind of went off air and then said we need to get back on air. Back with Utsile, I mean, what you said in the last episode, profound. I still hold those beliefs. There's a few things we didn't get to touch on. And I want to start with the thing that I've seen the most that's been most recent, The Habit of Gen Z. Mm. That was, I didn't get to watch it sadly enough and I tried to look for clips, but explain that process, explain what it was, how you felt, how you walked into it and what it meant to you.
So Habits of Gen Z, the Mnet miniseries, docuseries that was done on Gen Z. That was really just an opportunity for me to talk about young people, to talk about climate change, to talk about the state of the world and the state of the country. It was an opportunity for us to actually converse with the older generations. You know, many older people look at our generation and say, hey, those young people.
Yeah.
Is there hope for them? Or they like to say that back in my day, without really stopping to look at our day, because this is our time now. We're living through this time. We're still finding out what it means to be a young person in 2023, now 2024. So Habits of Gen Z was meant to be that dialogue between the young to the old, except we'd be the ones talking now. So it's a show where we express all the different facets of Gen Z, from sexuality to climate change and the state of the world we'll have to live in. Many different facets are spoken about in that. And so it was an opportunity to have a dialogue with us, multiple generations. It's an overdue dialogue. It's unfortunate that it was only on Mnet.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the people who saw it weren't really the majority of the people in the country. Mm. But you'd rather have taken the shot and tried to reach out than not have tried at all. But I think more people have a better understanding of Gen Z after having watched it. And I think it's on Showmax. So you might catch it on Showmax. If it's not on Showmax, talk to me after this. We'll see what we can hook you up with.
And I think the question there is, do you ever feel like that dialogue needs to be continued?
It does. Because you think about it, there's a very strange change in intergenerational dialogue right now in South Africa. Our parents' generation grew up having a lot of dialogue, political dialogue, with their parents about apartheid, about what freedom in our lifetime means, about democracy, about the movement. These dialogues happened so often that this great pool of leadership was able to pass down the wisdom to our parents' generation. How do I know that? People like you and I who have a history the one we do, where our families rooted in the struggle. I got to grow up sitting at the feet of my grandfather, asking him questions, soaking up all of that knowledge. That's a wisdom that really, it can't be limited to one generation. It is, in business, they call it institutional memory. It's an institutional memory. It's a lived experience. It's a wisdom. It's an understanding of the world. It's a passing down of philosophy that helps build not just a country, but it builds a society. An idea of putting people first. Mm-hmm. What it means, haribatu beli. So that's, this intergenerational dialogue is very much needed in South Africa right now, because there's a lot of this misunderstanding of generations. Our parents' generation misunderstanding millennials not understanding us. I mean, I hear millennials are terrified of Gen Zs.
Yeah.
It's something that needs to happen, especially in South Africa, because now we're talking about the politics of the country. We're talking about the future of the country. Millennials were left out of the political space. But it is going to become evident that Gen Z is not going to take the same path the millennials took. We are going to break through into the political space, seemingly simultaneously with them. Now, will we have a situation where, like the boomers had to the millennials, you have two generations that have an antagonistic relationship with one another? or will we have a relationship where we agree we're going to work together? We're going to build the country together. That our generational agenda will be fulfilled simultaneously. That we can work on what millennials needed to get done for their generation and work on what Gen Z needs to get done for its generation. It's a very important dialogue because, you know, I think it was a lack of that dialogue that was the reason why our parents' generation seemingly monopolizes the political center and power and doesn't pass it down to millennials the same way their elders did to them, the same way our grandparents' generation passed it on to them. You know, I talk about this very often. I say in politics, you had a generation of Nelson Mandela say, listen, I'm only staying for one term. Then I'm handing over to Thabo Mbeki, who's younger. Now it seems that that generation who had power that they didn't have to take, but power handed to them by their elders, seemingly now wants us to take it from them. But that's the opportunity for that to destabilize politics is very high. And we're seeing it today. Young people feel disenfranchised in the political space. Yeah. It's because we're not having that generational dialogue. Older people seemingly don't want us at the table, but we know we need to be at the table. So it's that question, what are we going to do? I think we need to have that dialogue. And I think it's in that they'll realize we're a lot wiser than they think. We have the right leaders, better leaders than the ones that they think we don't. And we can achieve a lot more, you know. I say this, I always put it this way. You need fresh new minds to come up with new solutions for new problems. We're living in the 21st century. We need leaders born in the 21st century to tackle the problems of the 21st century. The kind of people of the 20th century, and that's early on in the 20th century, determining the trajectory of South Africa in the 2020s and the 2030s, because that's the strategic leadership that is making decisions now. So yeah, a generational dialogue is needed.
I think my question to that as well is there's a cultural imbalance that exists. Because, I mean, in African culture, it's kind of respect your elders. And part of that also gets passed through culturally in our own politics, right? Mm. So older people don't want to listen to younger people because it's what do you know about the world that we don't? But the second thing is, in some people's eyes, we don't have a struggle.
Yeah.
We don't have an apartheid government who's oppressive. So we almost had life easy in their eyes. We have access to social media, the internet. We, like I said, we don't have a struggle in their eyes, which is seemingly very untrue because we have our struggle in our own right. And how do you convey that to say we should be in the room with you and you shouldn't be against us, but we should be orchestrating conversations to find solutions and that your struggle in part is our struggle?
It's a very difficult balancing act because we have to, one, as Africans, recognize that as part of our culture, we must respect our elders. But there are elements of that we can also adopt and adapt to governing. Because, you know, just look at what's happening now. Let's look at, for an example, King Zwelithini, the late Zulu monarch, ascended to the throne a very young man. Like his son, Misuzulu now. But he was able as a young man to lead because the elders didn't try and impose their will onto him, but they took an advisory role around him. They were advisors. They were, you know, people who he could run to for advice, people that he could go to for, say, he needs to make a very important decision. Who can he go to? And it's the same for Misuzulu. He had Ugacha. Mangosuthu Buthelezi, the late Mangosuthu Buthelezi. So older people in politics need to realize that in as much as we're really asking, I think there's a fear, they think that when we talk about generational handover, they think, that's it, pension, finished, done, you're gone. I think we must realize, we must help them realize that just as they had Walter Sisulu and Utata and Winnie Mandela to run to for advice, and they were, and you know, their elders were still part of the process. They too can still be part of the process, but they must recognize that a handover must happen in the country. But there must also be the recognition that, you know, the battles we'll face, the fact that they don't see it in terms of the struggles we are now going to have to face, but they see it still in terms of the struggle that they faced. And because we don't face it, now there's going to be that lack of maybe strategic leadership or leadership that can take South Africa forward. I think that's also part of what we need to say to them. That, listen, you don't understand from our generation's perspective where we want South Africa to go, what we are struggling with, what we are dealing with, you know. It's the fact that the Minister of Higher Education had to get it pretty much explained to him, the struggles of students who use NSFAS. He has to understand, they had to sit him down and go to great lengths to explain to him, you know, that when NSFAS doesn't pay, the reason why I end up having to drop out, or the reason why I end up having to take odd jobs and end up failing my semester and then you don't pay, it's all related to the strategic planning of NSFAS. It's all related to the systems you implement to pay out the money that we, the students, tell you, we don't want it. We don't want it this way. So it's multifaceted, you know. It's going to be a very difficult process, this in particular. But I think it all starts with having the conversation. I don't think we've actually had that meaningful conversation. Obviously, it'll be very difficult at first because, you know, I've had it said to me, you know, you young fellow, why are you here lecturing us about what we should... In the climate space, I get it all the time. But ultimately, I still come back to the point that, you know, it's so important that we can't afford not to have this uncomfortable, difficult conversation, because it's going to be uncomfortable and difficult. In some respects, it will violate what we view as the cultural and traditional norms of our country. But we are justified in doing this because we can see the tremendous potential for things to go off if we don't. But also, you know, they're not unreasonable. I mean, they too see in us themselves. They see younger versions of themselves. They too were jumping to lead. But they must now recognize that they can't put us in a situation where we have to take power from them. That for South Africa to really prosper, it needs to be, the Americans love this term, a peaceful transfer of power. And it's through that that nations prosper. The nations that prosper, by and large, around the world, have a very good transition and transfer of power, generationally. It happens very quickly. It's something we need to work on. Not just in South Africa, but in Africa. We have to work on it because we're not like the West. We have our own dynamics we have to work with. But we can't shy away from those conversations. So it's, what does democracy look like in that sense, in an Afrocentric framing? But it's possible. It's possible. I believe it's possible.
And do you feel that it's elderly people antagonizing the youth, or it's the youth antagonizing elderly people in terms of them being able to share the same table? Because I think I've been in many rooms where people are like, oh, these old people, they don't want to hand over power, or all these old people, they don't know what they're doing, or they don't know our struggle. And obviously that creates resentment for, I think, anybody in any generation. But we're once again at that war where we're at a standstill almost, saying both of us are speaking at each other, not with each other.
Not to each other. That's... I've seen it both ways, if I'm honest. I've seen the elderly antagonize the young. I've seen the young antagonize the older. It's a real struggle for power. No struggle for power is easy. No struggle for power is going to be peaceful. No struggle for power will have one good or one evil. I think we must understand that in this specific dialogue around this, there is no good and there is no bad. It's just interests. It's the same with politics. There is no good politics. There is no bad politics. It's just interests. There's no good and evil in it. I think that the saddest part as to why this question would come up is that I think the voices that are unwilling to have a fruitful and meaningful conversations are often the ones that drive the perception that leads to antagonizing on all sides. I mean, I don't want to make examples because I've made too many political examples. People will begin to say I'm targeting specific political entities. But we see it in our politics.
Yeah.
But not just in politics. I think we can even... Yeah, but let me not go there. I'm censoring myself because I don't want to go too far. But we do see that there is, on both sides, mutual antagonism against each other. It's just part of having this conversation. But I think the wrong part is if we look at it and we say, no, okay, this is getting too heated. We must step back now. We must just let it happen as it is. Because the wrong voices are the ones that will still keep going.
Mm.
And they'll be the ones who form the basis on which we have the conversation. I think, and this is specifically pertinent to this election in particular, because age has never been a greater issue as it is going to be in this election. I think what's going to be needed is that concessions are going to need to be made on the part of those who have power, and that's older people. Concessions, it's just you can't run away from it. I'm trying to sugarcoat it. There is no way to sugarcoat it. For the situation to become less hostile, for there to be an alleviation of the tensions right now, concessions must be made by those who have power, because clearly this whole struggle, this whole fight that's happening now is over power, it's over influence, it's over determining where we go from here. It's always going to come from where we go from here. That's where the main conversations around power lies. It's also, in some respects, the conversation around corruption and mismanagement and, you know, people getting in this to make themselves wealthy. You need people who weren't in the system, who weren't part of this culture, who weren't part of this politics, to come in order to sort of be indifferent to the style of cronyism that has taken over the politics of this country. It's that old saying, if you've sat around smelly fish long enough, you begin to smell like it. You begin to espouse that energy and that smell. And right now it stinks.
Yeah.
So we need people who don't stink to go in there and sort of freshen up the room and open up the windows. And we need to let go of a few people. I think we shouldn't be shy of saying that. There's a lot of people we need to let go of. But funny enough, I've heard it from older people themselves that, you know, damn it, my generation's messed up.
Mm.
It's very complex in that we can't generalize it because it's not all of them.
Yeah.
Because it's not also all of us, young people, who are antagonizing this. It takes a complexity, and I fear, perhaps I'm wrong, but I don't think South Africa is ready for that level of complexity yet. On a mass level, I don't think. We have an elite group of intellectuals, maybe, that can have that conversation. But unless we're able to have it on a level with the majority of the people of the country, we're not going to have that conversation, and it's not going to get meaningful. So you listening to this now, are you going to contribute positively to this conversation? Because me and Kumo can have these conversations. We can pull up a chair and invite an older person. But ultimately, the serious change happens when you have this conversation in your own household. And be prepared to listen to other people and have other people listen to you, and even come to the understanding that we're not going to agree on all of the things we want to do.
That's true.
All the things we want to achieve. But we must come to a common consensus on the fact that a shift must happen. A handover must happen. That must be the common consensus. Because just look at Biden. 80 years old. I don't think even older people recognize that that's a right thing for it to be happening.
Yeah.
In South Africa, our president is 70 now. I think he's 70.
Yeah, around
70
that
something.
Age.
70 something. I know he's 70 something now. TikTok was so mean for his birthday. They were so mean to him. That's how I know. But yeah, that dialogue must happen. The handover must happen. The dialogue is going to be very difficult. I always emphasize that difficult. It's going to be extremely difficult. It's going to be excruciating because you're going to feel like you're getting nowhere.
Yeah.
But as one of my teachers loved to say, if it doesn't hurt, means you're doing it wrong. If it doesn't hurt, means you're doing it wrong. If everything's easy and smooth, you're not doing it right. There's something you're missing. Something that is worth doing like this must be hard. I guess I should have just started with that.
I do want to ask something, because you speak about a peaceful transition and you speak about the struggle that exists in South Africa, but I think in the greater sphere of Africa as well. At what point do we as Africa move away from struggle politics in its idea? Because I think one of the things that we harped on about post 94 for the first 10, 15 years was, look at me, I was part of the struggle, therefore I should have my hand in politics. And I still think we're around that area now. I think just the people who have a claim and can attest to physically being there and attest to actually being a part of it, is the pool of people is decreasing significantly.
And dying off.
Yeah, literally age. What point do we then say, as the youth, as the country, to say that we are redefining what politics is and we are redefining the way in which we engage with politics? Because yes, it may be a struggle. Yes, it may be a fight. But at what point do we say, this thing doesn't have to be this difficult all the time?
That's an incredibly difficult question to answer. I suppose it would really depend. It really depends on the leadership. I think it would have to be the leadership that comes to that conclusion. I mean, bear with me on this idea. We followed this path for a very long time because it's been the norm of our politics. It's been how we have gotten a seat at the table. It's been how democracy was achieved. And like you say, for 15 years, you know, these were the people we trusted. You know, we said they were willing to lay their lives down, then surely they'd be willing to build up a strong and capable state and build a country. And, you know, by and large, have done some of that. You know, a little bit of self-sabotage.
Yeah.
But by and large, I think for our generation, we need to frame for ourselves whether our struggle constitutes something that can attest a similarity or at least an ownership to that type of politics. If we can connect to it and say our lived struggle and experience today bears these similarities, but and our politics therefore must have that same fire within it. Ask me personally, you know, I feel that struggle politics has gotten so hijacked by wrong actors and wrong people that its ability to, you know, contribute valuably to the process of just having basic discourse in this country and agreeing on what can be done, it's been so toxic that I don't think strategically it's what we should go forward with. I personally think that we need a progression. But a progression that we can define for ourselves. So, you know, look at, this is probably going to be a controversial comparison, but, you know, look at ZANU in Zimbabwe. You know, they ran on struggle politics for so long. And I'm not even talking about the economy, I'm just talking about the politics of the party and the politics of the country now. You know, it's gone on for so long, and it's been taken over by the wrong people for so long that it's sort of, people have mastered the art of seizing it, capturing it, and then using it for what they want. And that's what's happened in South Africa now. The alternative is that we must create a politics for young people that is still taking components of that that is valuable and can contribute to a proper progress around the political discourse in this country and around just politics generally and where we go, but also that is fit for a democratic state. Because now we're not fighting to overthrow a government. Now we're pretty much all the government. We are the government. Mm. We just need to get the government to act in the way that we want them to. And that takes an entirely different form. My fear, and it's something I've expressed privately, so it's the first time it's ever going to be public in any form. My fear is that we get somebody who maybe already might exist now in this context of politics that uses this to not only destabilize the country, but in some way manages to convince us that because our politics is still of a struggle, that we are not that far removed from an armed struggle and that we should take up arms. Because the way I've noticed politics around the world is that we're seeing more irrational, crazy actors seizing the microphone and doing with it what, the, you know, just look at right-wing populism in Europe, and now Latin America. Asia is going to surprise us in the 2030s, not now in the 2020s. I have a suspicion in the 2030s, Asia might surprise us by having a similar sort of regression of their politics. In Africa, we can't gamble like that. As an African country, we can't gamble like that. I mean, we were just talking about Fees Must Fall and the conditions. We also a TikTok of a girl talking about this, saying that, you know, the conditions are ripe for a coup. Mm-hmm. This is why I say struggle politics a little bit scares me like that, because it just takes one person, the right amount of followers, right amount of money, right amount of backers, and the state falls.
Yeah.
And my fear is that if that were to happen, you know, unlike in other countries, you know, could the South African state still stand? Oof. I mean, we've evidence suggests that their state of readiness might not be capable. The amount of unemployed young people in this country might just overpower. The amount of unemployed people generally might just overpower any ability for the state to still stand. And, you know, unlike in the 90s, where the type of violence I see unfolding in that scenario unfolds now, in the 90s, we at least had one figure that we could unify behind, Nelson Mandela. We don't have a Mandela now.
Yep.
So even if we were to successfully have a rebellion, what are the chances of us not falling into the trap of other states where then that person gets deposed and people begin taking the country by force? And, you know, people mustn't think that it's not possible. These things happen quite easily.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's so easy, particularly given the conditions of South Africa, for someone to do that now. But the threat that poses to you and I is that this person might have the right language, might talk the right talk, but as has been the case with many such events around the continent, they prove to do the opposite when they get into power. We don't have a Lee Kuan Yew. If we had a Lee Kuan Yew, might turn out well, but we don't, I don't see one at least. And so that's, you know, it's a very difficult link to draw.
Yeah.
It's, you know, debaters, someone POI and be like, how do you draw that link now?
Yeah.
I can already hear the POI. You just have to walk into a community that has lacked services for 30 years now, has seen leaders come and go, has seen motorcades of not just ANC politicians, but politicians from other parties come in and say, vote for me. And what other choice do they have? And then you have someone who still speaks the language of a struggle. Because remember, the language of a struggle is that it's preparing people to do something radical, something tough, something bold. And the fire's there for people to do it. It's just that threat in the back of my mind. It concerns me. Mm-hmm. I'm extremely concerned about it. When I'm at these dialogues with elected officials, I always express it to them all the time. I say, you know, you guys, you're really putting us in a dangerous spot here. You're really making the nation incredibly vulnerable. And I don't think you understand that when you're gone, the type of mess you leave behind won't just take one leader. It'll take a multitude of people to try and do it. And in that time, that is under the assumption that we don't have someone who comes along and tries by force to seize the nation and seize the wealth of the country, in the sense of a military or whatever type of coup, you know. It's very concerning. And adding to that, isolated incident. On TikTok, there's this guy. I don't know this guy's name. I never listened to him. But he was advocating for it, a former military something. And the scary part was that it was a trending clip. Like, the presidency even responded to it. But the scary part, oh my God. State intelligence services are trying to silence me. The scary part was that the responses to him, now this is on social media, so it's not a very good barometer of the country, but it's more or less a good indication. The response to him was not, what you're doing is wrong. The response to him calling for Sergeant General, something in the military, to implement a military coup in the country was that of, do it now, do it quickly, we'll support you. And to me, that's very concerning, because the thing about these things, you can't control where they go after they happen. That's the thing I'm very scared of. Democratic revolutions, I'm happy with. We've had a national democratic revolution in 94. Hopefully we'll have one in 24 or 29. Those ones are easier to control. Those ones, you know, it's the people's mandate.
Yeah.
But this one, you can't really control it. And that's the scary part. And that's the what concerns me. So this part two, maybe you can air it months later. You can air this months later. But that's a concern we must express. Because we don't really, democracy, us democracy experts, they'll tell you South Africa is in a very fragile position democratically. And that's why, so we vote. Me, Dafir, so many other young people are trying to do something. We're very concerned about where this goes. I mentioned December 2022. That's part of where I was starting to get, because we all, I'm not Cyril's biggest fan, but there's an air of stability and predictability to him that comforts me. Predictable, he'll be mediocre.
Yeah.
But you want something you can predict and at least respond to and try work to a better place than something you can't predict and you can't control. And your only means of control is mass revolution. And mass revolution is scary. And that's why I think we must go past that, because you can ask the founders of the struggle politics. They envisaged a handover to a generation that would take the politics of the country past it. I mean, I like to look at the language of those generation of leaders during and after the struggle. Their language is so much different after democracy. Their language around where South Africa should go, miles apart from in the 90s, like early 90s, 91, 92, just before 94. It's miles apart. They're not talking about building a state. They're not talking about building a state of politics that you have institutions for accountability now. You no longer need armed militants to achieve accountability. It's scary. But So long as we have leaders that try keep us away from that, we can get there. But we must also not forget, I'll stop talking after this point, because I talk a lot, you can hear. But we must also not forget that when we select leaders, you're not just selecting someone because of what they see, you're electing someone because of their judgment. The problem with struggle politics now is that we're electing people because of what they can say, not because of the values they espouse, not because of the judgment, the wisdom that they have within them to not destabilize things for their own self-gain. I'm fine with struggle politics as an idea, but under its current application, that's why I say a lot about wrong people. It has wrong people trying to control it. That's very dangerous. Yeah, you're giving, what did Begitale say? You're giving an ownerless gun to someone, and this person could just go shooting. And they shoot you and me.
Yeah.
We're citizens. We have power via the ballot. But in respect to infrastructure, to do something about wrong politics, let me stop there. I'm going too far. I don't want to complete that thought, because then
people will take it, they'll clip it.
People take it how they do it. I don't want this to come around and haunt me. I'll say the truth, and then that will be what stands.
I think two things is, firstly, when you were speaking, my mind instantly went to Nhlanhla Lux, and my mind went to Operation Dudula. For not the reason that I believe what they're doing is right or wrong. I think everyone's allowed to hold their own opinion. But for the reason that that is becoming our norm, we don't see that as problematic anymore. Which is scary to say, as South Africans, as people who have one of the most progressive constitutions in the world.
Yes, we do.
But obviously not applied.
Yeah.
But the fact that we are regressing and saying violence is okay, violence is the answer, that's a sign of people losing hope. That's a sign of people looking out for themselves. And that's a sign of people giving up on politics. But also in that is the second thing, which I think is the more interesting thing, is, does everyone deserve the mic? Because social media, influencer culture, which I think is growing in South Africa, which is, I think is only harming us. I don't necessarily, well, let me not say only harming us. I see some benefit.
Yeah, but the risk-reward ratio is off.
Yeah, the risk-reward ratio is extremely off. Is everyone gets to pick up their phone and gets to say, here are my thoughts on 1, 2, 3 things, and you trend for the next 2 weeks. Do you think there should be a limitation on who gets to speak, what they speak on? Or do you believe we just need stronger infrastructure to ensure the people who are saying not the right things, but are saying informed things are being put at the forefront?
Well, as someone invited here because of a clip I trended for, I'll be very careful on this topic. I think it's very dangerous, because this take. Not everybody contributes valuably. Some people digress the conversation. Some people degenerate the conversation. Some people have interests and agendas that, in order for them to be fulfilled, actively use misinformation and fake news. Social media, that's why I say in 2024, the election is going to be very difficult, because we have social media and this coming into play. I've never advocated for censorship. I don't think censorship has ever been anything that has brought forth positive feedback. But if I'm being very real about this, we should be very quick and very strong to condemn and to take down active misinformation. And, you know, that there's a freedom of speech argument to be made there. You know, in Australia, they just had the case where they banned the Nazi salute and Nazi paraphernalia. There, it wasn't a freedom of speech case. It was more of a public interest or public good case, that the association between this type of material and the actions it advocates, or the outcomes of it, are not in the public interest. Social media should be regulated in that sense, because you're seeing all types of madness unfolding there. Twitter's a dumpster fire.
Yeah.
TikTok's becoming a dumpster fire. Thank goodness Instagram's just photos. It's becoming, and that's just that, that's like leaving out Facebook, man.
Yeah.
But we're Gen Z, so we don't use Facebook.
True.
So, sorry, older people listening to this. If you use Facebook, I hate to tell you. But misinformation should be targeted. We should have more specific targeting of misinformation on social media platforms. TikTok does a good job. You can submit misinformation for review. Instagram, I think, does the same. Twitter,
Elon.
What did Elon do? He made a mess. But Twitter's really where the majority of these crazy crackpot conspiracies, organizations like Dudula get to form. And, you know, I'm not an advocate for Operation Dudula. I don't like it. I think the ability for this thing to turn into something wrong is there, and it's very quick. And because it's so... Yeah, it's a mess. But because it can exist like that, you know, we'll soon see organizations like the AWB start to resurface again. We'll soon see other crazy radical organizations that have no positive contribution to building a state, to building a democratic country, to creating stability and progress and prosperity, but organizations that will come with the single-minded interest of fulfilling an agenda, but an agenda that in most cases doesn't serve the community, doesn't serve the people, but only serves its leadership. I mean, you want to see the worst case scenario? Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And people think that's not possible in South Africa. People think an insurrection like that is not possible here. An insurrection like that, if it was possible in the United States, with the CIA, NSA, the FBI, and all of those entities, they were able to almost overturn democracy.
Yeah.
In the United States, a country that, for all of its controversy, more or less, we see as a stable democracy, then you can bet it's possible here. And organizations like that, that operate like that, have the potential to do that. And because people are so angry, there's so much anger. It's possible. South Africa has the terrible thing. We were blessed with a generation of level-headed leaders all at one time.
Yeah.
We don't have that many level-headed people left. Those of us who want to do something will try to do something. Sorry for the long dramatic pauses. I'm thinking whilst I'm answering. Let's move on.
I think...
Let us do three more.
Yeah, there's like three more questions. I've got 1,001 questions. I think there's a lot of that we have to speak about. There's the independence and elections, which I think is a conversation onto its own.
Oof.
But I want to ask, in terms of South African politics, and I think I'm going to do this as a double-sided question. Do you feel like, and this is going to sound very weird, but do you feel like we're in politicians' bedrooms and that affects our politics in the sense of, we know what they're doing, when they wake up, when they sleep. And South Africans have a thing to say, they know more than the next. So I've heard Cyril Ramaphosa's done X, or I've heard the person who was the maid actually is my cousin's uncle's friend, and therefore they told us this. My second thing then is, on top of that, is do you think South Africa needs to make politics a career the same way that the UK does? But obviously there's a bit of elitism in terms of having to have gone to Oxford to become prime minister.
And
true. But do you think there's a space where we need to intellectualize politics, because Thabo Mbeki, just on his outgoing and kind of his tenure, people say he wasn't intellectual. He was a good writer. The way he spoke, the way he articulated himself, he was an intellect. He valued intellectual politics. And I think that was a generation he was a part of, where being intellectual was your door, your step into politics. And we've stepped away from that to some extent. Do you think that influence needs to come back? Or do you think the Thabo Mbeki eras, the Oliver Tambo, the Nelson Mandelas, the people who were accredited because they were accredited, have led to a lack of politics being a career and it being intellectualized?
To the first one, I do think, okay, South Africans, we must shy away from rumors. Because in this day and age, it's not like in the early 2000s where more or less rumors you could track down where they came from. They weren't used as weapons to destroy or to fulfill certain agendas. Now rumors have been proven to build conspiracies, which build entire crackpot networks that do horrible things. Honest, to a certain degree, I do think when you're an elected official at any level, you do sign up to be held to a much greater standard. Is it an unfair standard? They might argue, sure. For them, I personally believe public service in that sense should be the highest calling of any person. And therefore, the way you carry yourself should be to a greater standard and to a greater extent. We can't have ministers and MECs and what you have it, members of parliament. Yo, just go and read some of the news. Just go to News 24 and look at the headlines. We can't have our officials behaving like that. Yes, they're human, sure.
Yeah.
But for that time, you put yourself aside and you are not the individual. You are the embodiment of the best South Africa has to offer, and you must behave in that way. Now, as part of that, I think that means that politics shouldn't be a career.
Okay.
I think you look at countries where politics has become a career, that's where we fall into the cycle that we have now. You know, it's easy to capture people. It's easy to capture the politics of the country. It's easy to drive all types of madness that is making the politics of the nation dysfunctional. So people who want to serve, you must serve, but then you must go on and do other things, you know. The countries that often have maybe not the most perfect democracies, but the ones we pretty much would like to be like, you know, look at, oh my gosh, this example is going to get me in so much trouble. Look at like the Australians and the New Zealands. You know, the typical countries people like to run away to. Their politicians come in for a certain time. They do maybe like 12 years, 15 years max. And then they leave and they go into the private sector. They go, they lecture in universities. They have a life outside of that. They do other things. The fact that they happen to be prime minister or what, is just another byline in their career. And most of them didn't study to be in politics. So to avoid the type of politics that we have, especially in South Africa, we must have people who don't make politics a career. People who come in, do their time as elected officials who show and espouse the best our country has to offer. And then they leave and they go have their own careers. Because then we also can avoid this thing where we have ministers in their 80s, presidents in their 70s. And I think then it'll also be easier for generational handover in some sense. I do think that it would work better that way. I'd need to analyze it intellectually. But that generation of intellectuals, I want to touch on the point that you brought up of the Thabo Mbeki generation. That generation of intellectuals, was South Africa both at its best, but South Africa both at its most elite? Because the whole reason we had, and this might be a controversial thing, the whole reason we went from like a Zuma, from Mbeki generation, from Mbeki style leadership to Zuma style leadership, was that Mbeki style leadership was seen as very exclusivist.
Yeah.
And when you're leading a country like South Africa, you can't be that elite, you can't be that exclusivist.
Yeah.
And so then the backlash to that was that he was removed at Polokwane, and then someone like Jacob Zuma, who was more the opposite of Thabo Mbeki, could come in. Not to say Jacob Zuma is stupid. Jacob Zuma is an incredibly intelligent person. Yeah. I mean, look at the man's political career.
Head of intelligence at MK. I mean,
MK. Not just that. He's political maneuvering. He's a man you can't. No one in modern politics can compare to him. Can compete with him right now. And so, that's also like something I add so that people don't say I'm calling Jacob Zuma stupid. I'm not calling him stupid at all. He's an incredibly intelligent person. But I'm saying is that the type of intellectualism of the Mbeki era shifted and changed because there was a backlash to that. And that's how we got the Zuma era. Now from the Zuma era, there was an antagonism of people of that Mbeki era, you know, the quote unquote clever blacks. And now they're being associated with the Ramaphosa era, which is...
Yeah, it's an era itself.
The silence. It's an era in and of itself. So it's going to need to be a very delicate balancing act. But it speaks to democracy, and I'll end with this. Democracy has to be representative in that way. If it's too elitist, like in the UK, you have a problem where the masses are disconnected from the state and the politics of the country. But if it's not at the level where you can debate it at what is quote-unquote an elite or academic level, then there's a nuance to the politics that is left out that creates the room for the sort of degradation of the state that we are seeing today. We haven't mastered the balancing act, but neither has any country.
True.
No country's mastered the balancing act. Like, what I'm outlining here is the ideal politics. But it's a politics worth doing, isn't it? I mean, think about it. We live now in a generation where more people have been educated than there are that weren't educated. We live in a generation where, because of access to healthcare, advances in technology, we'll be able to do more. We'll be able to achieve more. 21st century leadership brought by people actually born in the 21st century is going to be dramatically different. The opportunity for us to actually take the politics of South Africa to a place where we meet this balancing act, where we have it at such a level of sophistication that no one from the age of 20 to the age of 60-something could have been a politician or a member of parliament their entire career. That won't be acceptable anymore. You need to have either gone into politics, achieved something, then leave, not, you know, stink up the room or hog the microphone. We now can use these nuances and, well, use this lived experience of the country and create something. That's why I'm so optimistic about our generation, because we haven't yet determined for ourselves what it's going to look like. But if we start now, we can do something. We can do something incredible. And I've met the leaders that can do this. And the enthusiasm I have, I mean, guys, I'm going to try and make it possible. I'll be there on the sidelines. I like to say I'm built for the wings. So whatever turbulence comes, I'm ready. But I'm ready, and I think it can be done. And platforms like yours are bringing these types of leaders. And it's something we must encourage. It must be unacceptable to say you're going to be in politics forever. Being in politics can't be your only qualifier, especially now. In this election, people are going to talk a lot about experience. What does that experience equate to? I always tell people, don't vote on experience, because what is the experience you're voting on? State of healthcare? Does that experience make you feel comfortable? The state of Eskom? Does that experience make you... And don't just look at the governing party, look at the opposition.
Yeah.
People mustn't think of the opposition as powerless people. These people have a lot of power. So that's why there needs to be this constant shift. There's a part of a song I love. It's called The Future, but I think it's Alan Beck or something like that. It says, when the history has been written, what page will you be on? And we need to be on the side of history. We need to be on the page that shifted South Africa forward. Our generation can't be. Our generation needs to be the ones that, quote unquote, saves the country.
My last question to you, which I think speaks to part of our ability to have this conversation. How much do you think South Africans know their own history? Because we are a country that, I want to say glorifies, but idolizes people in moments mm-hmm. without understanding their process.
Yeah.
We speak about Mandela, we speak about Mbeki, we speak about Jacob Zuma, we speak about Cyril Ramaphosa. And for many of us who are young, we think these are people who simply have become presidents. For many of us, well, I don't want to say are learned. I just think I want to say are read, mm-hmm. you know, who are informed, who want to, well, who are curious.
Yeah.
They know the process, the story, the journey.
Mm.
And that, to some extent, I feel contributes to their ability to have conversations, but also to their ability to analyze what works and what doesn't.
Mm.
And in a South African climate, especially when I told you off air, I feel like we sometimes over-intellectualize politics. How much of our history do you think needs to be retaught for people to learn who they are, why they are, why South Africa is the way it is, beyond celebrating it in its moments, in its youth days, heritage days, freedom days, which, to be honest, yeah. most of us don't even understand the significance of those days.
We're just happy for the public holiday.
Yeah.
The question you're asking me is one of the questions that I struggle most with. Because these are incredibly, we have a very rich history.
Mm.
A history that has informed where we are today. You said that. But it sort of seems as if there's a fatigue with going over it again and again and again. And you know, you could look at this along racial lines, because it's been the cause of a lot of racial animosity in the country right now. I believe context is incredibly important. Context is incredibly important. Because without context, you go wrong a lot. We must be willing as a nation to acknowledge that given our history, we don't have the luxury of turning and looking away from our past. Our past, even for my generation, our generation, will inform our future.
Mm.
I think maybe by the time we have grandkids, we could maybe place not as heavy an emphasis on it. That was supposed to be our generation. But because of a lot of things that went wrong, it now still has to be our duty and our burden. So we must acknowledge our history, but we must also look at it beyond just a few faces, like you mentioned, you know. We now mention the prominent faces for the sake of people yeah. understanding what we're saying, but we must get to the point where we know all of the faces.
Mm.
We must get to a point where, you know, as a nation, there can be no subjective take on our history. One of the things I love about history is that because it is so well documented, history often, when the truth of it is told from a specific direction, from a specific point of view.
Mm.
When, obviously, people now have tried to make history a little bit subjective, I think that applies to history that's been censored, history
yeah.
that's been, you know, whitewashed a lot. I think when we talk about a nation's history, we must be very honest, we must be truthful, we must tell everything
mm.
so that the history we tell, the history and the context of our country that people know, is the history that we can all agree on as factual, is the history that we can all agree on as contributing to building South Africa, to where it is at the moment it's being told, and also that must be kept in mind as we continue building it. Mm. The narrative that we must just leave it behind, which has been something I've encountered a lot, I think it's not realistic.
Yeah.
Too many bodies are buried that still haven't been found.
Mm.
Too much blood has been spilled. There's so much pain and trauma still that exists in the country today for us to just turn away from it. It's impossible. We must live with this, but it doesn't mean because we have to live with it, it has to be a miserable experience doesn't mean it has to be a terrible experience. It can still be a very valuable and fruitful experience. We just need to have the ability to look at it, analyze it, have it as part of us, and still be able to build forward without constantly using it as an excuse for not doing better. Which I feel it's been used now as an excuse for not doing better. But I think that answers your question.
Mm.
And that's a good way to end.
It's a beautiful way to end. I can't lie. I feel like we're going to have 1,001 more conversations. I'm going to say this is too many more.
Yeah.
Because there's so many questions. I didn't even get to touch on the climate change questions I had for you, which is the second part.
We'll do that at the debrief.
No, yeah, definitely. I want to say thank you again just for being so insightful, being wise, and just sharing your truth. Because, you know, I think a lot of people have been afraid to share their truth. But also people have been afraid to mobilize their truth, you know? Like, a lot of people want change. A lot of people are eager to have it. They're urging for it. But they're sitting there doing nothing. And that's volumes in itself, you know? They say silence is one of the biggest, loudest sounds. And that's the truth.
If you have a good head between your shoulders and you have the ability to do something, you ought to do something. It's just all we ask of you.
And I appreciate you so much for coming. I hope to get in contact with everyone in the Western Cape just so I can also hear their point of view, hear what they're doing. And once again, as always, this has been Misunderstood.